I assume most people have not heard of me. Most people. I am a lifetime research scientist. I worked for 32 years in the pharmaceutical industry and biotech. My most senior positions were at Pfizer. I was vice president and worldwide head of research in allergic and respiratory diseases. Since 2020, I have been speaking out against the fraudulent pandemic and the intentionally dangerous injections. And my experience has been to have been censored and smeared largely. So if you've not heard of me before, that's the reason that censorship and smearing is the experience of people who try and tell you true things that the authorities don't want you to hear. I don't want to give up because I'm, you know, nothing to say, but I think I've said enough that if anyone's looking at what I've said or is looking for me, they can find me easily enough. And if they're not, putting out another 10 videos or 100 videos is not going to reach them. So I think there'll be things for me to do. I think this could easily be a year of major change, but I can't see the point in doing that much more, frankly. I've done over 300 video and audio interviews, and I'm more concerned than I was in 2020, 21. I'm more certain, unfortunately. I wish I wasn't. I'm more certain of the tentative concerns I had then. I've got a much better understanding of the history behind what I call the nonsense, the 2020 lies of the not pandemic. And to inject people with the not vaccines. Yep. I got a much better understanding of all of the work that's preceded it. When I first spoke, when I did a major interview in 2021, I was at that point sure that there wasn't a pandemic, or at least whatever was happening had been deliberately and through planning exaggerated to frighten people. And I focus very much, because of my history as a research executive in pharma for over 30 years, I was very concerned about the injections, because I knew there wasn't a public health threat, so why would you want to be injected? My thinking has advanced quite a lot since then, which I may talk about later in this interview, but it's not possible for the injections to be of help to anybody. It's literally not possible. Every medicine, every molecule and atom and constituent of every medicine is in there because somebody chose to put it in there. Hopefully for good reasons, but they put it in there for a purpose, to stabilize something or make it big enough to swallow in the form of a tablet. If you just had the active ingredients in some drugs, it's too small to see. So you need to formulate it with it, what are called excipients. So, but when I spoke before, I could see multiple features in the so-called vaccines that was not necessary, even if I believe the lies that about what I was being told about these things, even if you believe them, it would not be necessary to incorporate certain features about them. And so my bottom line is, I think, and I'm well qualified to make this claim, probably better qualified than any other single person speaking out, they have been designed intentionally to injure, kill, and reduce fertility. I've never claimed it would do it to a lot of people, or that it would be quick. In fact, specifically, I remember saying at the time, I don't think they want to risk injuring and killing too many people early on, because people will spot it. What I expected once I started looking around and noticing other things, like there was a talk of electronic money, getting rid of cash, and there was talk of digital ID. I remember Tony Blair trying to do that in the 90s. And frankly, I joined the dots, and I could see a world in which you were required to have digital ID, that cash was removed, so you had to spend only using digital money. And I thought, you know what? If I was the evil person, I would say that your digital ID will not be valid unless you're up to date with your injections. And I came across a document from the EU. It's called EU Vabeco, V-A-B-E-C-O. And it's a scheme that started in 2018. Bottom line is, the EU Commission anticipates a future in which every EU citizen has a digital ID whose validity is governed by whether or not they've been injected with the latest mRNA-based, quote, vaccine. So they anticipate regular injection for the rest of your life. That's, you know, if you, and the idea is it'll improve health and safety as you travel around, which is a lie. It's a lie. You being vaccinated doesn't protect anybody. In fact, I would recommend no one has any vaccines at all, from what I've discovered in the last year or so. But, you know, honestly, when have governments ever given a flying one about your health and safety? You must know that a claim that you must do something for your health and safety is what is called, it's an excuse, it's an ostensible reason. These people who are trying to take our lives away from us always use two things. It's always two things. They'll tell you about something using the excuse, the ostensible reason. So in this case, it'll be you have to be jabbed to protect you from marauding viruses. The real reason is I'm afraid they want to make you ill and kill you. That is the truth. It's absolutely clear. There's really only one senior institution. It's a group of people who you can see as supranational groups, from the UN, WHO, the International Panel on Climate Change, the World Economic Forum, you know, Bilderbergs. You should see them as the same. They're different manifestations, Trilateral Commission. Keir Starmer's a member of the Trilateral Commission, the only elected British politician who's a member of this globalist group, at least that particular one. They're all founded by the same group of people. They've been running for, you know, decades to much longer than a century. And they believe their destiny is to control all us little people, all us. They see us as useless eaters. Useless eaters. Where have you heard that phrase before? What happens to useless eaters, do you think? I think they believe it's their destiny, maybe their obligation, to take control of everyone, everywhere, forever, using digital means. So digital ID, digital money, geolocation, and an obligation to be injected, something like that. You don't need much more than that. The control mechanism is so frighteningly simple. I warn people, and I'm not going to sign up for digital ID. I'm probably going to regret that statement, but you don't need a new global single format editable digital biometric ID. But that's what digital ID means. Single global editable biometric digital ID. I'm warning you, I'm trying to help. It's the last really important decision you will get to make. If you sign up for it, the people who are taking over do not require your consent, your collaboration, you to do anything after that. And this is why I'm going to tell you why. Even I, as someone who's not involved in finance, I'm clever enough to see that the debts of all major countries has been deliberately piled on and escalated to the point where it's obvious to all of us that the debts can never be repaid. We're struggling even to service the interest on the loans. So at some point, I predict with great confidence that an event like 2008, the global financial crisis, only 1,000 times worse, will occur. And that will mean every country is bankrupt at the same time. All businesses would be bankrupt at the same time. And to find out what will happen to you, if like me, you're sort of comfortable and middle class, early retired and got a bit of saving, you should be really frightened what I'm going to tell you. David Rogers Webb. David Rogers Webb. Here's my sole, my matching half in finance. He's a retired hedge fund manager who discovered that the laws pertaining to private property rights have been altered over the last 50 or 60 years surreptitiously in every country on the planet. So when you think you own something I invite you to look in. If you've got an investment account, you will find now, you won't find any statements to do with ownership. You'll only find the phrase beneficial owner, beneficial ownership. It makes no difference most of the time. You can buy it and sell it. Let's say it's shares, stocks, bonds. You can receive dividends and so on. But the small print says, in the event of a large enough default, all the financial intermediaries who owe money to the people they borrowed it from, and then they owe money to the people they borrowed it from, in the event of a large enough default, the senior secured creditors, the people at the top, may seize the assets ever pledged as collateral by the layers below them. That includes your house, your pension, any stocks and shares you have in an account with an intermediary like Hargreaves Lansdown, AJ Bell and the like, JP Morgan. Basically, legal theft of all of your assets will occur, I think, within hours of a large enough financial crisis that I've just discussed. So even if you didn't think anyone was plotting against you, I think you would agree with me that, in fact, I factored in it when I was doing retirement planning. I assumed there would be at least one other 2008 during my life, and I set out my affairs so that I would probably be able to survive that. But we can't survive this. So yes, I think there will come a time between now and 2030 where legally all your assets will be stolen. I remember there's a lady called Catherine Austin Fitz, who's a finance lady. She says, I believe that possession, where we're talking about objects, not humans, but where it comes to objects, you really only own it if you can sit on it and defend it at the point of a gun. And I know she says it to get a laugh, but there is something to that. If you've left any assets with a third party, maybe you own some gold and it's in the bank. Maybe you do have, you know, a large pension with a financial intermediary. Upon the large enough financial crisis that is being engineered, because, as I'll explain in a moment, look how useful this is. At the moment of that big enough financial crisis, all of the institutions will be bankrupt and all of the assets will be moved legally, stolen legally, and they will belong to the senior secured creditors, because those assets have at some point been used in a financial transaction. There's no point in you protesting that they haven't told you they borrowed it and it's not really theirs. This has been tested in a major court in New York, where one financial institution was both the custodian and acting on behalf of senior creditors. So it stole the assets of another of its clients, and it went to court, and I'm afraid it was found that they were legally able to do that. So David Rogers Webb, a free book called The Great Taking, is my gift to you. You should go and read that. So that's part of the takeover. It is a takeover. It's a global coup. And I've explained that if you sign up for digital ID, it'll be the last really important decision you make, because your digital ID will be the only thing that your governments, institutions, and anybody authorized by those holding power will recognize you through. So you won't exist anymore. You'll be replaced by a QR code. You are not a number. You're an address to some resources. And that makes it particularly dangerous, because those resources can be edited. And one of those fields for sure will be your vaccination status. And I'm absolutely sure, because I've seen it written down in multiple documents, that your digital ID will only remain valid if you comply with the conditions of validity. So one of them will be, have you had your latest recommended or mandated jabs? And because of the fact that I'm qualified in toxicology and work for decades with others in what's called rational drug design, when I look at these jabs, the constituents, I am certain, formally certain, that they were designed to hurt you. And so, you know, the digital ID will lose validity unless you roll your sleeve up. You must see that's designed to injure and, I believe, ultimately kill you. But you won't be able to escape that, because all your money will also be associated with your digital ID. So let's say you've gone to a supermarket, you want to buy a drink and a sandwich. You'll beep them through and it'll say, how do you pay? And it'll say, present your digital ID. And the cash register, as it were, the cashless system, won't proceed until you show it your QR code. And if you're not vaccinated, and if that means your digital ID is not valid, it'll say, sorry, transaction refused. The merchant will not be able to sell you the product. So you can see how difficult this is. Now, a valid digital ID, just like a valid passport, is today required to cross a border. And I've no problem with a passport, of course. But I'd be pretty cross if to buy petrol, I had to show my passport, or to buy a bottle of water, I had to show my passport. But that is what's coming. You'll have to show your digital ID. If you said hurty words on the internet, you might find that your digital money doesn't work. If you're outside of your 15-minute zone and you're not authorized to be, you will not be able to buy anything. That's what's coming. It's the ultimate tool of slavery, the digital. It's called the digital gulag by other people. I think that's not a bad phrase. And the way to stop that happening is to put your foot down and don't sign up for it. If they tell you, say you're, if it's the government, they might say we're not going to give you benefits unless you sign up for digital ID. I can't help that. I'm going to tell you, you at this point have to choose. Obviously going to engineer it so that you'll feel you can't refuse. If you sign up for it, your life is going to end. Your free life is going to end. So I would say, like I always did with the jabs before I really knew what was going on, I would say, don't decide anything now. Defer your decision a month, maybe in another month. Same with digital ID. Please, when it's first put to you, and especially if they threaten you, we'll have to fire you if you won't sign up for this. This is good for you, is it? Why would they threaten you? Why would they punish you for not doing something that's supposedly good for you? And the answer is, I mentioned earlier, always two reasons, the ostensible reason, the excuse, or the real reason. And the threats come because the real reason is what I've been telling you. It's for bad. So if they tell you they won't pay your benefits if you don't sign up for digital ID, I'm going to ask you to swallow hard and not sign up. You might have to sign up in a month or 3 months. Don't sign up. The more people who don't sign up, the more likely we are to be able to defeat this, because other people will be taking their lead from you. So if you've got children, I think you should be willing to go hungry for a bit. If I have to, I will, in order to stop this happening. So I've made the bold statement, I'm not going to take on a digital ID. And some people have said, you will lose access to your money in your bank accounts. Do you know what? So be it. If I sign up for it, what's going to happen is what I've outlined to you. Money's not going to matter. One, they'll steal it. And secondly, I don't want to survive in a world in which I'm beeping my way into and out of shops and beeping my way to buy some moldy bread with insect flour, right? I'm not going to live in that world. So I'm just going to stop. And the worse the punishment threatened, brought upon me, the worse the retribution, the more sure you should be that this is a bad thing. So even if they say we're going to fire you, say respectfully, I don't trust this system. I'm going to defer my decision. I'm not going to sign up this month. Let them fire you. I think they'll have to give up. Remember NHS 100K when they said, we're going to jab you all or you'll lose your job. And 100,000 of them campaigned on the street. The government actually gave in the next week. So there's enough power if we only just take our courage in our hands. And you only need courage when you're threatened. You need some courage now. You need some courage now. I'm not frightened. I don't look frightened because I'm not frightened. Everyone's life comes to an end eventually. I don't want it earlier than necessary. But if I do what I think these evil tyrants want me to do, the end of my free life has been reached. Honestly, I think we can defeat this if enough of us are reasonably brave. You don't need to fight anybody. It would be pointless. They'd love you to get young, strong men. If you get fighting on the street, I bet the government would love that. Never been my style. But the way to fight it is literally not to comply. So don't sign up for digital ID. I would say if they tell you there's another scary event and you need to go home and stay in, go out for a long walk. Go and find several friends and go for a long walk. If you believe at this point what you're being told on the mainstream media, I've lost all sympathy for you. So you don't have to do the research I've done, and you don't have to be a conspiraloon at this point to work out that something very bad is happening. So don't let them inject you with anything, is my recommendation. And don't allow yourself to be locked down or forced to wear masks or frightened by anything. It's all lies, all of it. And you've got to take your courage in your hand now and think, do I trust the BBC or this guy, Dr. Mike Eden, who warned you about the toxicity of the expected toxicity of the injections I warned about in writing before they were authorised in December 2020. And every day I've wished I was wrong, but I'm not wrong. And having been right about that for 4 years, then I think at least do me the honour of exploring some of these things. So I've talked about David Rogers Webb. Another person I recommend, Ben Rubin. Again, I recognise a brother. He was in corporate. He was in corporate consulting in one of these, I think KPMG or PricewaterhouseCoopers. And he has discovered that 20 years of his career was to do with like globalising corporate systems, information systems and so on. And I think when he realised that he'd been part of, preparing an unpleasant scenario, a bit like me with pharma. Luckily, I'd retired before I realised what was going on. But just to be clear, I would not take a commission in pharmaceuticals or biotech anymore. I wouldn't work in that sector anymore. I don't trust it, and I don't think it's a good thing. So Ben, look at what Ben Rubin is saying. Ben is a guy who spends a lot of time looking at like whole of governments, looking at whole of corporations, looking at integrated systems. And so he will do a much better job of explaining, as it were, politically, how we got here. But I think I'm pretty good at telling you, don't take the vaccine. And don't be frightened by the lies they're going to give us. That's what I would say. And for goodness sake, don't sign up for digital ID. If you feel compelled to, I'm really asking you, defer the decision to do it and watch the punishment, and know that if it's genuinely good for you, why the dickens would they punish you? Why would the threat escalate until they might even say, if you won't take it, we're going to imprison you? You know, they won't start there. They will literally start there with a financial disincentive. So defer the decision, even if you think you're going to have to sign up, please, because I think we can defeat them with that one move. And the other one is, don't believe the lies anymore. There's nothing much to be frightened of other than humans, really. Other plotting humans are the thing you should really worry about. And there are plenty of them, and I'll name one of them, our former Prime Minister, Tony Blair. He's not a good person. He's really not a good person. So he came into government, you will remember, not left, not right, but the third way. Do you remember the third way? What it involved was public-private partnerships, which meant we'll borrow money from private financiers and we'll spend it on public services. So that means your country will improve without you having to pay any taxes. And when I heard that, I thought the chickens will come home to roost. And so we got lots of new hospitals. We didn't have to pay for them at the time. We were just servicing the loans, something like that. Chickens have come home to roost. The government, the country now has enormous structural debts. And I think debt repayment it's either the second or the third largest item on the budget already. It's more than we spend on education. Next year, it'll be even more. And, you know, it will become the largest budget item if the country survives long enough. That, you know, so Blair, we voted him in. Blair has, all the other countries in the West have been guided to do this. So they've all borrowed so much money that they are effectively bankrupt. There's probably no hiding from that, but let's not make it easy for them. So, yeah, they bankrupted the country and they've hidden that, but it's very clear to people like David Rogers Webb. And I anticipate we'll have other scares. Like, honestly, if they tell you about bird flu, you know, it's like a chicken with a cold. You know, have you ever seen a chicken with a cold? Have you ever seen them coughing, sneezing? Birds don't get flu. Birds do not get influenza. They don't. They do not get influenza. Spend 5 minutes looking at the bird, the respiratory tract. Look at the lungs of a bird. And you realize it's like, it's so different from a mammal's lungs. It's like you would realize why they can't get colds or flu. So they're lying to you about these illnesses. Birds can get sick, but they haven't got flu, and it's not contagious. So, and the PCR test is a measure of nothing. It's fraud. And when they tell you, oh, we found bird flu in a flock in Aldermaston or something, they will have used PCR, which is fraudulent, to get that result. And they could make the birds sick in any number of ways, just by treating them badly. If they overcrowd them, that will make them sick. If they stress them, that will make them sick. And if they then come in and test them, they can claim bird flu in the flock. Then they can kill all the birds. And then they can say, oh, look, bird flu's going around. Then they'll lie and say, first case of bird to human transmission. It doesn't even exist, because like I told you, birds don't get colds. Birds don't sneeze. Have you ever seen a bird coughing? You must know they're lying to you. And I wouldn't think monkeys get pox either. Really. They're hairy. Anyway, I haven't looked at that one in any great detail. But what I have looked at since I last gave a substantial interview, this one's often very difficult. When I was younger and I was taught biology and so on, so I didn't work in virology. So I remember being taught things and then I remembered them. And I'll come back to what knowledge is in a minute. So I was taught that colds and flu are caused by submicroscopic infective particles called viruses. That's what I was told. They float around, you inhale one, if you're susceptible, you get a cough or you get a cold, whatever it is. And that model seemed okay. I didn't work in the field, so I never examined it again. And this is an example. I'm asking you to ask yourself what you know, what you really know. I've had to do that I thought I knew quite a lot, and I've realized over the last 5 years, I don't really know anything. So knowledge. I think there may be multiple kinds. I'm not a philosopher, but there's at least two different kinds. One is things you know because you yourself have like done the work. Maybe if you grew some crops or had cared for an animal or another person. Things you know from things you've done personally. You've verified them. Then there's the other knowledge, which is most of what we call knowledge, which is, I would characterize it as someone told you and you chose to believe them. If you ask yourself honestly about what you know, how much of what you know belongs to the second group? Someone told you and you chose to believe them. I think it's most. So I had to be humble, not the big man, you know, big clever scientist. I realized most of what I've been taught is a lie. Wasn't an easy thing to come to grips with. Partly why I wouldn't work again in the sector. I couldn't even do an honest job because I don't trust the literature. But here's the thing. So I was told this is how flu and colds work, that flu and colds were due to submicroscopic infective particles called viruses, and that you caught them from another person, you could give them to a person. That's what I was told. That's the model. That's the scary thing they tell you. That has been tested in formal settings. A clinical trial in a case like this would involve volunteers who've got colds or flu spending a few hours in a room with a healthy person. And then the two people would go their separate ways, and the experimenters would follow up the healthy person over the next days and weeks. Now, if contagion transmission was occurring, you would expect over time, the people who've spent a few hours with someone with a cold or flu would get colds and flu more often than the people who didn't spend time in the room with the person with cold and flu. And they had matching controls. People spent time with someone who was perfectly well. So they were the controls. They went off. The people who spent time with a person with a cold, they went off. And here's the thing. For 100 years of these clinical experiments, the people who spent a few hours with the person with a cold or flu got colds and flu no more often than the people who spent a couple of hours in the room with a well person. contagion of acute respiratory illnesses does not happen. Now, many of you will protest and think, I'm certain I got it from my brother-in-law, or I gave it to my workmates. I will say those observations are consistent with contagion. They're not proof of it. There is another explanation, and I don't have the whole answer, but I believe I've got a good alternative. If you, a person who gets headaches, especially a migraine, when you've got a migraine, how often do you ask yourself, I wonder who gave me that migraine? Who did I catch that headache from? You probably think, what are you talking about, Eden? Everybody knows that you don't catch them, you develop them, whatever. How about this one then? If you're unfortunate enough to have angina, maybe occasional chest pain, maybe from stress, maybe from not very fit. The next time you get pain in your chest, do you think, I wonder who infected me with that angina? It's like, no, the headache and the chest pain result from things going awry inside you, equilibriums being lost inside you. I believe, as a respiratory expert, that colds and flu are the result of a loss of normal equilibrium inside you. And so they occur from time to time. If you go from cold to warm environments, dry to wet environments, and vice versa. If you're stressed, if you haven't slept, if you've slept with your mouth open, your nose is a fantastic filter. And I think those are the things that trigger colds. We get colds quite often. I probably get a couple of minor colds a year. Flu I've only ever had twice. So colds happen so frequently. This is how it works psychologically. The next time you get a cold, because you've been told you catch them, you'll think, who did I see that had a cold? It's like, I wonder if that guy in the checkout who was coughing. Oh, no, it's Dave at work, or my sister-in-law had it. And you will attribute your symptoms to those encounters, because that's what we do. Humans are great at forming patterns. And I'm telling you, it looks like that, but that actually isn't how it works. And so next time you spend time with someone with a cold and flu and don't get a cold in the week or so afterwards, remember, Mike did tell us, you don't catch these things from other people. So, that means you shouldn't be frightened if they lie to you and said that there's a bird flu or, influenza or whatever it was called, COVID, because it doesn't work like that. These diseases do not work like that. They're normal illnesses. Your experience of them is a good guide to what will happen to you if you get one, which is mostly you spend a few days feeling a bit rubbish and then you get better. If it's flu and you're not old and ill, you might have several days where you're really unwell and in bed, but then you get better. So honestly, there's nothing to be frightened of but your other human beings. Do not get vaccinated. Contagion is a lie. You don't have to be paranoid if they really are after us. I would like to come back to something very, very important that I've discovered. It was absolutely horrifying. And when I tell you, and it's right in my field of expertise, I was the vice president for years of new therapeutics for allergic and respiratory diseases, ANR. I will credit the terrific work of two Americans, Sasha Latipova, L-A-T-Y-P-O-V-A, Sasha Latipova, like me, a retired pharma executive. She worked in development, I was in research. And a legal scholar called Catherine with a K, Watt. Catherine Watt, W-A-T-T. They write on Substack. They have uncovered the fact that vaccines have never been intended to reduce diseases or to help you. They have always been what I have determined the COVID shots to be, which is materials that harm you and do you no good. And of course, that's so horrifying that you think, oh my word, all of them? Yep, all of them. I'm not saying they're all as dangerous as COVID jabs, but none of them were good. And rather than trusting me, go and read the work of Sasha Latipova and Catherine Watt, and then it's up to you to decide, okay? If you think that's wrong, that's fine. But one thing Sasha and others discovered, and they shared it with me before they even published it, and as soon as they told me, I knew it was right. Can you remember a time, those of you who are over 60, I'm nearly 65, can you remember a time when you were young when very few people were allergic to peanuts? And very few people were allergic to anything. You probably can, can't you, older folk like me? What we discovered is that if you inject a person with a foreign protein like peanut oil, if you inject a person with tiny doses of that, especially if you do it two or three times, that person becomes fiercely allergic for life to peanuts. Imagine if you were to inject a whey protein from milk in a tiny dose, so small that you probably wouldn't even notice it on the ingredients list. And if you injected that into your child a couple of times, when they grew up, they might end up, not all of them, but many of them will grow up allergic to milk and milk products and anything that's got whey protein in it. Imagine if they injected you with a beef protein that came from plasma, for example. You often see that in products. A tiny dose, a really tiny dose, so small it'll be off the bottom of the ingredients list, and you injected that person twice with it, they'll become intolerant to meat. Unfortunately, that is all true. All of those ingredients have been found in at least one of the vaccines on the vaccine schedule in America, and they're pretty much global products. These diabolical people have included components in the jabs that your children have been given and you may have received that were designed to sensitize you to every single basic food item. You know, to wheat, to corn, to beef, to chicken, to milk. That's why the number of people, I think like one in three people has some kind of allergy. It's like, they didn't, when I was young, they didn't. Sasha Latipova was born in the USSR. And as she said in her fruity Russian, she said, when I was young, no one had allergies. When she came to America, I think in the 80s, it was like, what gives? And so she was probably perfectly poised to spot this. And so she discovered this, and she noticed that a scientist called, I think it was Charles Richer, something like that, 1902, 1905, given a Nobel Prize for discovery of this mechanism. If you give tiny doses of foreign protein into a person, separated by 2 weeks, they become violently and permanently allergic to that substance. You know, even if you touch it on the skin or put it just in your mouth, on your tongue, or certainly if you eat it, you've got a worse than even chance of having an allergic response to it. These people have sensitized you, those of you who have been vaccinated, to large amounts of the natural environment. I mean, how diabolical is that? And it's exactly the same mechanism as I called out in 2020 about the COVID jabs. Remember I said that if you ask the human body to make a protein that doesn't belong in you, a non-self protein, a so-called spike protein, wherever it came from. I said, if you do that, it will make you, your body will cause an autoimmune reaction, or your body will then make foreign material. Your immune system will say, what the hell is that? And will attack it. So it's like a failed organ transplant. It's autoimmunity. That's what has happened through the whole history of vaccination back from the late 1700s to the present day. And that's pretty bad. So that's what I wanted to tell you about vaccines. And as a result of that, I am proudly anti-vaccine of all kinds. Remember, I told you at least where it comes to acute respiratory illnesses, they are not contagious or infectious. They're not caused by viruses because there's no scientific evidence for the existence of respiratory viruses. I know this. I've done the work now. I've studied all of the literature. I've studied the clinical side, I've looked at the cell culture side, and as soon as I did, it's so obvious to me that each of the so-called pillars of evidence are fraudulent. They are fraudulent. I haven't personally looked at every virus, but if you go and speak, if you go and look at recordings by people like Stefan Lanka, Samantha and Mark Bailey, Andrew Kaufman, anyway, there are several brilliant people. I reached my own conclusion by doing the work in respiratory and allergy. I have to say, I'm going to leave it to other people to do the work in their own fields, but that has allowed me with confidence to say the things I now say. If any former colleagues, please, want to talk to me about that, if they think I'm wrong, I'm not wrong. I can show you chapter and verse, all the literature references going back to acute anaphylaxis. I've used these models in vitro in industry. It's like, and how do we achieve them? You administer foreign proteins twice, about 14 days apart. It's like amazing how I didn't spot it. People don't spot things. I didn't spot things, even in my, what the Americans call your own wheelhouse, because you're not suspecting people are out to harm you. You literally don't interpret this action, which is bad, because you're not looking for bad motives. So now I am. I can see so many things. I understand some people don't want to even tackle this topic. And I've been warned by people that if I say acute respiratory illnesses, colds and flu, are not caused by infectious particles, they're not contagious. If I say that, the people will not believe me. Well, I'm not going to lie. There's no point in me sitting here and telling you anything if I don't tell you the truth. I'm sure it's true. Some people will reject everything I've said because of what I've just said. But I can't help that. But I am qualified to have done the work. And you may note, I restrict my remarks to acute respiratory illnesses. Because that's where I've done all of the work. I've read all the papers. I can show any other scientist what I can send them a list of the papers if they want. So if someone thinks, no, he's wrong, if you're a qualified scientist and you think I'm wrong, contact me and we'll have a phone call and I will send you the papers. And I think you will have to conclude, as I do, that contagion isn't a thing. Obviously, those illnesses are real. I've had two bouts of flu. But dozens of colds. But basically all I'm telling you is that the attribution, the mechanism of them happening is not what we were told. It's something else. I've spent a lot of time working with others in designing, therapeutic aerosols, things that you can inhale and will land in the airway. So I know a little bit about the internal architecture of the lungs. You may have heard statistics like the inside surface of your lungs, if spread out flat, is about the size of a tennis court. I mean, whether that's exactly right, I don't know. But it's big. It's a big surface area. And every part of that internal surface is covered by a thin layer of liquid, which has got little mucus in it. Imagine your body all day and all night for a whole life has to regulate the thickness, the depth of that little layer of water. If it's too thick, or if it's too thin, or if it dries out, your lungs won't work properly. But I think occasionally they do veer off course. Patches of your lung lose control of what's called airway surface liquid, the wetness on the lining of bits of your lung. I think that's what a cold is. You know, seriously, I'll also offer one last piece of evidence just to show I've done the work in my own area. You may know some people with cystic fibrosis, CF. It's a very unpleasant disease. It varies, though, in severity from, oh, I didn't know you had CF, to poor babies that don't make a year old. What's the key problem in CF? It's to do with regulation of the state of hydration of your lungs and also your gut to some extent. People who made adulthood with cystic fibrosis, not the most severe cases. What's the most common thing that happens to them? They get colds very often. They can't regulate the airway surface liquid layer very well because the cystic fibrosis problem they've got, that's part of the machinery for regulating it, is broken. When I thought of that, I thought, oh my word, that is why. So basically your health excursion, you know, getting worse and then getting better again, is very similar to the episode that some people with cystic fibrosis have, because I think it's fundamentally the same mechanism. It's not caused by floating particles called viruses. It's caused when you, it's not a conscious thing, but when you lose control of the balance, it's called homeostasis, when you lose control of the balance inside health of your lung. You might just get a scratchy throat, a bit of a cough, and you bounce back. Oh, I thought I was getting a cold there. Or you might get a bit of a cold, or you might really go down with something chesty, or you might have to take to your bed. And I think those are like a nested series of excursions from health and back to health. All right, that's what I think colds and flu are. They're not contagious, they're not caused by viruses, and I've given you a better explanation for what a cold is than the official story. So I invite you to take that on board. So yeah, I understand people not wanting to speak about viruses, but I think if you know the truth, you just have to speak it or get off the stage. In many interviews, I've been keen to tell people that there wasn't a pandemic, there wasn't a public health emergency, there was nothing unusual happening. Sometimes I'll refer to the numbers of people, you know, going into hospital or dying of things. But I've got something that I think is more useful. In order for an emergency to be declared, like a fire or like a shark approaching a public beach, you know, holiday beach, would you agree with me, ladies and gentlemen, that before you would call out the fire engines, you'd probably be smelling smoke somewhere, someone would be, or a smoke alarm will go off. Before you would call shark alerts and get everybody off the beach, you'd think someone would have seen a fin, yeah? Or someone in a helicopter said, hey, I can see some sharks approaching the beach. What I'm telling you is before an emergency is called, there is already an event at some level that someone is able to see, to detect, and warn you about, and you think, oh, that's really good that they warned us. In the case of the pandemic, that nice man at the WHO, Tedros, clever he may be, but he's not a fortune teller. He doesn't have foresight. He hasn't got long-range binoculars. He's not got a time machine. In order to declare a pandemic, which I think he did in 2020, March, whatever it was, he has to have some evidence of that. There's a little problemette, ladies and gentlemen. Not just me, but Dennis Rancourt in Canada and many other researchers have looked for signs of illness, respiratory illness, which surely would be growing somewhere in a small way in order that the WHO from their Siemens exalted position could aggregate all that data and go, oh my word, it looks like there's something that, like a pandemic beginning. There is nowhere in the world that you can find increased frequency of respiratory illness and respiratory deaths anywhere until after the WHO called a pandemic. Ladies and gentlemen, they called a pandemic with no evidence of a pandemic because they were lying to you. They were lying to you. Then they created our governments created the impression of a pandemic by misusing a test that doesn't measure what it says, PCR. There's literally, what we had is a pandemic, a rollout of the test. It's as simple as that. Increased number of cases everywhere was a pandemic of a rollout of a rubbish test. It's not a mistake. They knew it was rubbish. They designed it to be rubbish. They designed it to produce positives where there was no illness. And then when people died, they said, oh, they had COVID. They literally did that. And then I'm afraid medical procedures in care homes and hospitals led to people being killed. But this is old news. You've heard all this before. I just wanted to tell you, you can't have an emergency without some sign of that emergency emerging somewhere. You need that information in order as a leader to say, I'm afraid, folks, I've got bad news. There's an emergency coming, batten down the hatches. For these pandemics, they just lied to you. Nothing was happening. If you go and look for it, you'll not find the evidence. They called the pandemic, and then the data started arriving, which was fraudulent. So it's as simple as that. If you do nothing else, have a look at, the Club of Rome, the Trilateral Commission. Honestly, things like climate change and diseases that pandemic were decided to be used by people concerned about population, which is no evidence of real concern. They decided at the same time to frighten you with diseases and changes to climate. It's the same group of people at the same time. And after that, there was a diaspora of propaganda. And honestly, people might say you're not qualified, but you know, I'm very qualified to read the scientific literature and to find my peers. So I've found at least three or four people who've spent longer in atmospheric science and climate than I've spent in pharma R&D. And there is no question that there is no significant change to the climate of the world since pre-industrial times. Some people think it's a degree warmer or so. We're not sure. We weren't measuring it very much. Honestly, where do you think they got the temperature data from when there were virtually no thermometers? And they weren't calibrated to each other, and no one checked what the records really said. So this idea that they know it's 1.5 degrees, it's a lie. The temperature of the world has changed much more than that, repeatedly in geological history, much more than that. But the key thing you should know is there is no connection between CO2 in the air and the temperature of the surface, by which I mean, because people say, oh, it's a greenhouse gas. It's like, yeah, we don't live in a greenhouse. A greenhouse is a closed system. If you modify CO2 in the atmosphere, a pretty much open system, all that happens is the bits that are warm transfer their energy to other atoms, and then they radiate them back out into space. The reason we know this is that there are ice cores from deep polar ice that have been looked at by several independent groups. What they all show is, yes, temperature has modified over time. Atmospheric CO2 has modified over time. Here's the important information. Changes in temperature always preceded change in atmospheric CO2. Atmospheric CO2 moves in response to the change in temperature. Warm water doesn't hold as much CO2. The seas are big. There's a lot of volume of the sea, so there is a lag. But after temperature of the air has warmed up, after a large lag, the sea warms as well. It releases some of its CO2. Everybody knows a fizzy drink loses its bubbles, which is CO2 dissolved, loses its fizz when it warms up. So you know what I've just told you is true. Warm water holds less CO2 than cold water. When the old Earth warms due to changes in solar output, modification of our non-circular orbit, alteration of the angle of the Earth to the solar ecliptic, any of those things and maybe others, whatever it was that makes the Earth warm or cool, it's the CO2 movement takes place afterwards and in the same direction. So all of this fear-mongering about burning fossil fuels, adding CO2, and that will change the Earth's climate, it is a lie. And they're lying to you to frighten you and to get you to accept, for example, restriction on internal combustion cars. Given what I've just told you is true, why would you not have 100-year-old technology that's being refined and refined, and is the exhaust coming out of very good cars today is cleaner than the air coming in through the intake in any city that's a bit grubby. It's that good. Catalytic converters, nitric oxide converters as well in things, especially in diesels, computer-controlled fuel injection, stop-start. They're literally the air coming. You can't smell petrol when you walk around London. When I was a kid in a big city, my eyes would stream from the raw petrol pouring out from the cars. So there's no justification for restricting the use of cars, petrol cars. You know the restrictions with electric vehicles. But my conclusion from watching other people who understand engineering, the push for EVs is nothing at all to do with getting you into an EV. It's to get you out of your internal combustion engine car. And the zero emission vehicle mandate that our government has specialized in, which requires automotive manufacturers to sell a higher and higher proportion of their total sales as EVs each year, the effects of this will be to destroy, to bankrupt and reduce the mass manufacturing conglomerates, people like Volkswagen, Audi Group, Ford, and so on. They will be bankrupted. Now, they may be collaborating with World Economic Forum or not. It doesn't really make any difference. The quick example of Volkswagen, Audi, they're not allowed to sell the number of cars we would like to buy, petrol and diesel, because the company and the main dealers know that they'll be fined £15,000 a car if they don't sell 28% as EV. So they're going to restrict, and they are already restricting, petrol and diesel sales, and it's only 2025. They also can't sell very many EVs because the European cars are a lot more expensive than the cheap Chinese imports. I'm not having a go at China. I think this has been arranged by global financiers. On the one hand, it's like a 1-2 punch. You can't sell petrol and diesel because we're not going to let you. And oh dear, your cars are uncompetitive with the cheaper Chinese cars. There are 180 Chinese EV makers. At the moment, I think one or two is profitable. And I saw a press report from, you know, the trade press that said by the end of this decade, 7 to 9 of them will be profitable and the rest will have gone. What that tells you is someone is willing to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to manufacture cars, I would suspect, at a loss in order that they can be delivered to Europe at a loss in order to destroy the mass manufacturing capability of Europe. And as a result, it'll be, oh dear, there are simply not enough cars to go around anymore. So they, in the end, they won't need to mandate it. There literally won't be any. So, and so that's one big concern I've got. You might think, why would I comment? I like machinery. I commented before that I like wrenching, spannering my own vehicles, cars and bikes mainly. And I was filmed in 2020 in my bike shed. So I've paid attention at least to automotive changes. I recently had a hire car on holiday, which was brand new, and I hated it. The thing is full of surveillance technology. It's full of, I think they're called ADAS, Automated Driver Assistance System, something like that, ADAS. And it's an EU set of regulations, but it will be rolled out worldwide. And they're the things that are slightly irritating, that beep at you if you're 3 miles an hour over the prevailing speed limit. Will shout at you if you don't stare at the windscreen constantly. If you take a hand off the wheel, it'll tell you to put your hand back on the wheel. Those have, on average, I read in a trade press, some over 10 cameras in the car, only a few of which are outside. Most of the cameras are facing inside and facing you. You are being recorded at all times that you're driving. It's so one of them focuses on your eyes so that it's checking whether you're looking through the screen, whether you're tired or not, if your blink rate slows. And this is not to assist you. This is ultimately to ensure that you will not be able to control and drive your own car. So let's give you one example. You must have heard of 15-minute cities, even if you think it's a conspiracy theory. Just imagine your 15-minute city is a radius of, say, 3 miles from where you live. It might be that much in bad traffic. With these always-on cars that are connected, what do you think will happen when your vehicle crosses the edge of that 15-minute boundary? I know what's going to happen when it is turned on. The vehicle will probably slow down. It probably won't stop immediately, but it will be disabled. It'll go into limp mode, and you'll only get into first and second gear. They're not going to allow you to drive out of the 15-minute zone in a modern car. And there are so many other things. That's called geofencing. Geofencing, one word. Go and look it up. I know personally somebody whose car was updated as a favour from a dealer, and when she got it back, being a lawyer, she happened to notice that she had to accept new terms and conditions. And she had plenty of time, she went through the terms and conditions. And one of them was, when you say okay, you will allow the manufacturer and the authorities to activate geofencing software in this car. That's what they're going to do. So, you know, and that will ultimately be probably related to your things like your digital ID. Otherwise, where do they know where you are? Well, with the car, they know where the car is. But they probably want to associate the owner of the car. They'll know who's in it because your face is in multiple cameras. So they'll know who's in it. If you try to cover your face with a mask, I suspect the car won't start, if that isn't already incorporated. If I was an evil person, I'd design that. And you can assume that whoever's running this are more evil than me and more imaginative. Is this the world you want? It's not the world I want. Honestly, I would detach the internet, turn it off, and jump up and down on all the digital devices if I could. Lots of things would become inconvenient, but it's a much better world. And what's crucial about that world is it cannot be taken over by a small number of people. These digital devices are essential for the global coup d'etat, which started in 2020. Without that digital technology and the ability to communicate with you, to alter what your mind is thinking about, what you pay attention to propagandize you, and ultimately to regulate you through digital ID, without that, they couldn't do this, all of this control. People say, oh, why do they want to do it? It's like, I don't know exactly. I used the example in several previous interviews that if you witnessed an assault of several people were attacking someone on the pavement, and you phoned the police and said, there's an ongoing attack and I'm worried a guy's going to be killed. I've seen a flash, which I think is a knife. Will you get someone here? Wait, straight away. The police go, wait. And before we come out, we need to know what the motive is for the attack. It's like, see, asking why they're doing it is an understandable question, but it's not material to whether it's actually occurring. It is occurring. I don't know exactly why they're doing it. I don't know. I think they're deeply evil people who feel entitled to control the life of people like you and me, who they regard as profane, useless eaters. That was a phrase used by Mao, by the way, before he took steps which led to the deaths by starvation of hundreds of millions of people. I think these people have absolutely no difficulty in taking steps that will lead to the deaths of hundreds of millions of people. It's been done repeatedly, and these people are entirely comfortable in doing it. And they are doing it. So I've said to people, you didn't know that the injections were dangerous initially. You do now. Anybody who rolls up their sleeve now and has an injection, I have no sympathy for you whatsoever. I know that's an unpleasant thing to say, but I'm not trying to be a diplomat here. If you are so stupid and uninformed that you will allow yourself to be injected again, I have no sympathy for you. I think it's very important to recognise that there aren't any heroes out there that are going to descend from on high and save us, and I'm certainly not one. But there are very large numbers of us, and the people who are trying to take our freedoms away need us to comply with things in order to control us. And I'm saying to you, we will win if enough of us bottom up simply refuse to go along with their harebrained plan. So if they want to frighten you with some mad pandemic that doesn't happen, don't be afraid. If they want to tell you to stay at home when it doesn't suit you, go outside. If they insist you wear masks, don't wear masks. There's no possible benefit for you wearing masks. Certainly, if they're wanting to roll up your sleeve, do not accept any injection, certainly not of these mRNA technologies. They certainly like their digital control technology, so do not sign up for digital ID and many other things, really. But try and stay healthy. Go and talk to real people. Give them a hug. And eat good food, exercise, be out in the daylight, and we'll be all right as long as enough of us do not comply.